Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to tonight's edition of Jump Right In, a production of 1111 Broadcasting. I hope you had a great weekend. It was a little chilly here in Florida, but nothing we couldn't handle. Spring is coming. I just cannot wait. This is Splash, and my pond is open. We had a great show last Thursday. We talked about DUIs being down and stoned driving being up. We also talked about how the California greenies put the mental in environmentalist. We zapped the IRS for zapping small businesses without cause. We exposed Obama's war authorization request for what it is, cover for putting boots on the ground all over Europe and the Middle East, and wondered why Syria is still crossing Obama's red line on chemical weapons use and getting away with it. Lots of good stuff, so if you missed it, go to our blog, 1111broadcasting.com, so you can catch up. Of course, you can check out any past episode of Jump Right In right there on our blog, 1111broadcasting.com. And you can like us on Facebook, 1111 Broadcasting, and you can even listen there right on our Facebook page. Tonight, we will talk about the new Elmo Congress and how they showed a glimmer of hope that they could actually govern and then immediately ran off course. If they don't check their compass and adjust their rudders, then they're going to run the risk of running aground altogether. We are also going to talk about ISIS and a little diplomatic interference from a surprising source. And I actually have an apology to make. No, not of the Brian Williams magnitude. But when I need to apologize, I do. And so I will. And that will lead us right into the Yemeni meltdown. Wasn't this a fine example of a partnership in counterterrorism that Obama held in high esteem this past January the 20th. Anyway, so much to cover, so little time. The number to call, 215-383-5730, 215-383-5730. I encourage you to jump right in, wade carefully if you must. But remember, in my pond, everyone swims at their own risk. We'll be here for the next hour doing the thing I love to do most, talking smack about politics. If you want to chime in, just give us a call. I promise to bite, and I promise that you will love it. You can jump right into the show chat room tonight, you'll need a free login from Blog Talk Radio. It takes less than a minute. Put in your email address, pick a screen name, a password, and voila, you can jump right into the chat room, pick on people, or even pick on me. Now, if you want to participate in the show, put your stamp on tonight's episode, wade into my pond then. By all means, dial the number right there at the top of your show page, 215-383-5730. That's 215-383-5730, and I would love to talk to you. Put me to the test. It'll be your time to shine. Now, before we get into tonight's show, let me tell you about Choice Mattress and Furniture. When it comes to mattresses and bedding, David Ritter and the staff at Choice Mattress and Furniture know their stuff. I took my family to Choice Mattress and everything was considered, from the weight to our height to our age, even the way each of us sleeps. The right mattress was personally selected for each of us. And now my whole family sleeps in great comfort all night long on beds from Choice Mattress, and yours can too. Every mattress carried by Choice Mattress comes with a 5, 10, or even 15-year 100% full replacement warranty, not a prorated limited warranty like other stores. Chances are, if you bought a bed in the Daytona Beach area in the last 20 years, then you bought it from David. With over 20 years experience, David knows beds. And you should see all the other fine lines of furniture Choice Mattress has for every room in your household. Go to see David and the fine folks at Choice Mattress and Furniture, located at 1501 North Nova Road in Holly Hill. That's on the corner of LPGA and Nova Road. Or just give them a call, 386-226-BEDS. That's 386-226-2337. Choice Mattress, simply the best choice that you can make in your sleep. Now, before we dive into the new Elmo Senate, I want to just touch on something so endearing that I just don't care. I don't care what side of the aisle your politics dwell. You just have to love it. And I'm talking about, of course, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg saying that she wasn't 100% sober for Obama's purchase of the Union Address last January. And you got to just love that honesty. Blame it on the alcohol. If you want to talk about this, 215-383-5730. That's 215-383-5730. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, this is from Politico, blames falling asleep at this year's State of the Union address on not being 100% sober. The audience, for the most part, is awake, she said, because they are bobbing up and down as we sit there. You know, they're doing the standing ovations, and the Supreme Court just sits there stone-faced, she said. It was according to CNN. Now, she continued, but we're not, at least I was not, 100% sober. I'll tell you what, if I had to go to a State of the Union address given by Barack Obama, I probably wouldn't be sober either. In fact, I'd probably be completely shit-faced. Ginsburg was famously caught napping at the 2010 State of the Union address, and some reported seeing the Supreme Court justice dozing off at the 2015 address as well. Ginsburg admitted that this year she had slept through the speech, as I often do. She's 81 years old, for Christ's sake. Cut the lady some slack. And I love that. She admitted that she slept through the speech as often as I do, she said, as if to say, I can't help it if the president's boring me. Anyway, as to how she became somewhat inebriated, she says, I vowed this year just sparkling water, staying away from the wine. But the dinner was so delicious, it needed wine. And, of course, she was speaking about a dinner party beforehand, which Justice Anthony Kennedy brought, she said, a very fine California wine. Now, give this woman an endorsement contract. She is the ultimate poster child, so to speak, the ultimate 81-year-old poster child for a fine California wine. Now, she reported getting home from the event to call a call from one of her granddaughters, who calls her Bubby. And her granddaughter said, Bubby, you were sleeping, Ginsburg said. So she was called out by her own grandkid. Now, you know why I love this woman? First of all, she's so blatantly honest. Yeah, I slept through the president's speech, so it's the president's job to keep me awake, not the other way around. Secondly, politics aside, she is a tough old bird, unwavering in her beliefs. And as much as I don't agree with all of her views, she will not let even the Smurfs bully her into stepping down so that Obama can name her replacement. I love her, and as I have said before, I hope she outsits even the next president, no matter who they turn out to be. But I just thought that that was just a fabulous story, and I got a real kick out of it, and I hope that you did too. But I do want to go ahead and get into the new Elmo Senate tonight. And if you want to talk about that, give me a call, 215-383-5730. That's 215-383-5730. The GOP-controlled Senate, I'm going from an article that I read in Politico, and the GOP-controlled Senate is looking a lot like last year's Democratic Senate. Failed procedure votes, short and fruitless work weeks, and prolonged periods of inactivity on the floor. And this is exactly what I warned the Elmos not to do. What did I say? Pass bills. Send them to the president's desk. Let him be the single and only obstacle to things moving forward. What did the president say? We should curb the minorities. What was the words that he used? We should curb the frequent use of the filibuster because it stops the majority from advancing their platform. Well, who's the majority right now? But in any case, this is what I warned them not to do, not to get bogged down in this kind of stuff. So let the president say no, not the minority in the Senate. Let him say no, the president. and this was my advice to the Elmos. Pass bills through both chambers and send them to the president's desk. That's what I said. I did say that, right? And that is what they did with the Keystone bill. A couple of bumps from the minority, but they passed it, and it is on its way to the president's desk for an almost certain veto. But that's okay. But then the Elmos became their own brick wall. With this stubborn impasse on the Homeland Security funding, which has sapped the chamber's ability to do much else for the past 2 weeks, aside from small, you know, little things, and as lawmakers skip town for a 10-day recess, some Republicans worry that the fight could drag far past the February 27th deadline, particularly if Congress ends up passing a short-term funding band-aid that merely sets up another cliff. Now, I want to talk about this so-called cliff, because they're always talking about this one is a cliff that they're calling cliff, because, once again, both sides are playing on the public fears that if we don't pass this bill, suddenly the Department of Homeland Security is just going to shut down and leave the United States defenseless against those who would do us harm. That is simply not true. 87% of the people at the Department of Homeland Security are considered essential, and we continue working without pay through any shutdown. They would all be back paid once the stalemate was broken. The DHS could function indefinitely under a shutdown. Indefinitely. Furthermore, and I love this part, the immigration functions of the Department of Homeland Security are funded primarily through fees and fines. So immigration policy, the entire reason for this impasse, would remain funded even during a shutdown. So you can't tell me that that's just not brainless to take this route. And this is what I'm talking about with the Elmos. They're just not being smart about this. Many in the Capitol see a short-term extension as the most likely solution to keeping the Department of Homeland Security funding from running out at the end of the month, especially with the chamber's deadlock on language that would roll back the president's immigration policies. Of course, the Senate Republicans are already expressing frustration that they've wasted too much time trying to appease their House counterparts by voting repeatedly for the same doomed DHS bill, which Democrats have filibustered 3 times. High-ranking GOP senators are sending a warning flare to the House. The only thing worse than missing the first deadline of the year would be fighting this battle all over again in March or April. Now, I'm just going to say, missing this deadline is not the end of the world. It's pretty far from 2016. If they can get their bearings and make some adjustments and realize that this is not the way they want to go, they still have a chance to get on track. But that is true. Instead of passing no bill to send to the president's desk, the Elmos could split them and send 2 bills, which is what I said. Send many, many, many bills. One bill would fund the DHS, and one would defund Obama's amnesty order. But the Elmos' insistence on having their cake and eating it too will have to wait until they also gain the White House, and that is not going to happen if they keep doing this kind of stuff. But splash, Obama is overreaching and legalizing illegals, and then going to grant them tax credits retroactive for 4 years, totaling more than $20,000 per family. We have to stop him. I know, but you can't. You just can't. Listen, most people are beginning to hate Obama's immigration policy. The truth is coming out. That is that it is just a great big wholesale purchase of the Latino vote. Latinos vote Smurf, not because they are willing to let their illegal brethren stay, but because it showers their households in which those illegals live with tax credits. It is a cultural thing with Latino community. And, you know, we might get to that later, but and we might not get to that till tomorrow, but I promise I'll get to why that's true in tomorrow's show, this week anyway, but probably tomorrow's show. I will get to that. But I want to stay on point here for now, Senator John Thune of South Dakota, the number three Senate Republican, said, "We've got to get off this. We've got to get this behind us. We have to, at some point, bring this to closure. A short-term DHS funding deal would be a bad outcome for the Senate in terms of us being able to do other things. If we have to do a short-term extension, then we've got to revisit this. The next time it comes over, it will take another couple of weeks." And he's right on target with that. So not only are they not sending two bills instead of none, but the whole process is stopping them from working to send even more bills up to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So this is a real problem. The partisan stalemate is also undermining Republicans' attempt to show that they can run Congress effectively as they head into a tough fight to keep the Senate in 2016, which they will never keep if they keep this up. Never. The point now is to pass separate bills so everyone goes on record and we know where everyone stands. Everyone. If you combine the bills, like the DHS funding and the immigration rollback, then suddenly voters really can't tell why, what anyone stands for, why they voted for or against something, or carry any message into the voting booth with them in 2016. This battle should end, said Senator Mark Kirk from Illinois, Republican from Illinois, who wants a DHS funding bill with none of the immigration riders that the House attached to its version in January. Now, here's a smart Elmo. He says, "When we were given the honor of the majority, we have to govern wisely. Shutdowns are not wise policy for key national security-related departments." Forget the shutdown. Nothing really shuts down. This is about efficiency. This is about moving that legislation through the gears of Congress, gears that Prince Harry religiously grounded to a halt for the last 4 years. It's about sending that legislation to the president's desk. The DHS bill would be a feather in the Elmo's cap because it would be a bill that the president actually signs. It would be more of the same. It would also be exposing the more of the same my way or the highway crap that we've been getting to know and love over the last several years. And it would give the Elmos a bill that the Smurfs obstruct and the president vetoes in the immigration rollback. It would be a legislative trifecta for the new Elmo majority Congress. Now, as for a solution to the stalemate, Senator Jeff Flake, Republican of Arizona, responded, "Take the same time we're doing this and pass an immigration bill. That's what I want." Another smart Elmo. See, they do exist. These guys just need to guide the other boneheads. Flake says we could be doing a lot of things. And of course, he helped broker a deal for the comprehensive immigration reform that Speaker John Boehner would not bring up to a vote. But other ideas for resolving the standoff are in short supply. House conservatives on Thursday floated a trial balloon calling for the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to gut the Senate's legislative filibuster. Of course, Senator Ted Cruz and Dan Sullivan had to awkwardly shoot down at the joint House and Senate Republican news conference. They shot that down. Instead, McConnell is setting up a fourth failed vote on a three-time filibustered House bill after members return on February 23rd. Oh, there is no reason to change the filibuster on legislation just so you can get a single bill passed. You would rather let the Smurfs keep filibustering just the filibuster. Remember, it was the Smurfs' own president that said repeated use of the filibuster, overuse of the filibuster, is something we should not do. And yet, here they are doing it. He was complaining about when the Republicans do it, but here they are doing it on this bill. Be that as it may, the benefits of splitting the bill are far more than letting the Smurfs filibuster. But that's far better than changing the filibuster rules altogether. Now, though House and Senate lawmakers in both parties despise the idea of a short-term extension, continually relitigating the funding fight would be particularly painful for Senate Republicans, both functionally and politically. It took McConnell a month to pass the Keystone Pipeline bill because of his desire to allow open amendment process so any short-term DHS bill would serve only to further delay Republican priorities like Obamacare repeal, which isn't going to happen, tax reform, which is looking unlikely, and the new trade deals, which are having trouble as we speak. Now, but do you see, this is the Smurf strategy. Delay, delay, delay. They feel like if they can delay things, they're going to make the Elmos look like they can't govern. This is the same thing they were bitching about only 3 months ago. So let them do that. Let them do what they were bitching about. That's fine. And when they fail, let the president veto. But don't delay yourself. Don't veto yourself. It doesn't make any sense at all. One of my favorite business books, its title is Ready, Fire, Aim. It's by Michael Masterson. The book discusses the four stages of a successful business's life cycle. The first stage, of course, is the most harrowing because, as most businesses fail in their first 6 months, one of the biggest internal obstacles to launching a business is the belief that you actually have to have all your ducks in a row before you can even test the marketability of your product or service. You do need to line up some of your ducks, but that's just the necessary ducks to get started. But requiring every single duck to be in place before you make a single move can prove to be paralyzing. Here, the Elmos are launching a brand new opportunity so that they can prove what they did not prove from 2000 to 2006, that they have the product for the American people. Unfortunately, they want everything all at once. It looks like they were moving along fine. They allowed debate. They allowed votes on the minority amendments. They passed the XL pipeline bill, which is now on its way to the president's desk. Even if Obama vetoes that, the exercise was still a success and time well spent for the Elmos. And then they pull this nonsense on the DHS bill and throw a wrench right into their momentum. The Republicans also don't want to add anything else to their already full plate of deadlines, especially in the Senate, where one lawmaker can cause days of delays for legislation. After the February 27th deadline for DHS, they get more deadlines. March 31st, Medicare providers face steep cuts in their payments unless Congress passes a law to stop that. The transportation funding is running out in May. In June, some portions of the Patriot Act expire. Meanwhile, the Senate Republicans aim to pass a budget this spring. They begin writing appropriation bills for each arm of the government, contentious debates that will take lots of time. And raising the debt ceiling looms either in the summer or the fall, depending on how they do the accounting there and how the deficit goes. Now, with that workload in mind, a continuing resolution that creates another Homeland Security deadline is not on the top of the Republican swish lips. So separate the damn bills. It only postpones the problem, kicks the can down the road, says Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine. Another cliff doesn't solve anything. As I stated earlier, it's not a cliff, but Susan is right. It doesn't just postpone the problem. Postponement is the problem. It is not just about the battles you pick here. Rolling back Obama's unilateral amnesty program is the right choice of a battle. So it's not just the battle you choose, but it's how you choose to fight that battle. Combining the two bills is the wrong way to fight this battle. Let the amnesty rollback stand on its own. Let the two sides line up. Let them make a stand. And then the voters will know who supports and who does not support executive amnesty. You know that the president is about to veto the XL pipeline bill, not because he objects to the pipeline. He may still approve it, doubtful, but he may, but because it takes power reserved for the executive branch when a project crossing a national border is, whether or not a project is crossing a national border is in our national interest. It takes that power, that decision, away from the executive branch and gives that power to the Congress. Here, the president has taken power reserved for the legislation, that being immigration law, and usurped it for himself. Let each and every representative and senator take a stand on this issue, unencumbered by any other issues. Let the Smurfs say no. Let the president veto it and move on. Next! Now, though the GOP Senate has looked much like its gridlocked Democrat predecessor, party leaders have emphasized that February's stalemate does not mean a revival of the do-nothing Senate. This month, the Senate confirmed a new defense secretary, a drug czar, and passed bills aimed at preventing suicide among veterans and aiding victims of child pornography. None of those required much debate, and all but the confirmation of defense secretary nominee Ash Carter passed unanimously. Great. So in a single month, the Elmos have done more than Prince Harry did in 4 years. That is good. But why overshadow that with this debacle that will never get out of gridlock? It makes absolutely no sense. Yet even with the Republican caucus, come back. I did not see that. Oh, okay. Anyway, pardon the interruption, folks. Yet even with the Republican caucus, there's been turbulence about the multitasking. Even on those less contentious items, some conservatives argue that the Senate should do nothing but let Democrats sit on the obstructionist hot seat, an argument that has not gained much traction as most Republicans try to look past the DHS battle. Listen. This is what the media is going to do. When you Elmos obstruct, it was your fault. When you did that when you were the minority, it was your fault. Here, the Smurfs are doing the obstruction, and it's still going to be the Elmo's fault. Don't do it the way the Smurfs did it. Don't attach two separate items of legislation, split them in two, and have twice as many votes, twice as many stands taken, twice as much progress. That's what you need to do. Senator Rob Portman, Republican from Ohio, said, "I don't think we should shut the place down." Now, he has big plans for tax reform and trade, so he has reason to want to move forward. We've got to continue to do our work and not get distracted, and that's exactly what they're doing to themselves. They are getting themselves distracted. With all these smart Elmos, why are they going for yet a fourth doomed closure vote? It makes no sense. The Republican leaders admit that the chamber hasn't been the paragon of legislation debate that it was when the Senate was taking score of amendments on the Keystone last month. But if anyone's to blame for the lack of movement on major legislation this month, Republicans say, it's Democrats who won't let the Senate debate the House Immigration DHS package. That is so true. That is what the Smurfs are doing. But it is still you Elmo's fault. Don't ever forget that. Just remember that when you are the obstructor, whether you are the obstructor or the obstructee, whether you are the majority or the minority, whether the chicken came first or the egg, it is still all the Elmo's fault. This is why it is imperative that you stop being boneheads and doing things the way the Smurfs did them. Be efficient. Be smart. Pick your battles and then fight them correctly. Never forget that. It is frustrating that the Democrats have filibustered the bill, said Senate Republican Whip John Cornyn of Texas. This is the kind of dysfunction that voters repudiated. I can't even believe how stupid this is. This is the kind of dysfunction that voters repudiated in November. And the sort of fallback into the same bad habits is a little frustrating, but I think it's just a temporary bump in the road. That is not the kind of dysfunction the voters repudiated last November. You Elmos were doing the exact same thing, filibustering, blocking things, and the voters decided to still put you in charge. What the voters repudiated was the Smurfs, as the majority, could not get things accomplished in the Senate because they insisted on having everything their way, and that's exactly what you're doing right now. You are insisting on having these two bills linked when you should be splitting them. And you're going to pay the price. And that is what the Elmos are starting to do now as the majority. If you keep it up, you too will meet the repudiation of the voters two Novembers from now. To get back on course, you need to only look back and review what you did with the Keystone Pipeline. And that, to me, was by far some incredible progress that we haven't seen in quite some time in the Senate, especially. Hang on one second here, folks. So when we're talking about that as the Elmo's first major success and model for how the Elmos should legislate, that's what the Keystone Pipeline exercise was. And if you want to talk about that, the number to call, 215-383-5730, 215-383-5730. Hang on one second, folks. But a standalone bill forcing everyone to make a stand, whether Obama signs the bill or not, that was what the Keystone bill was all about in my mind, even though it was about building the Keystone Pipeline. Republicans held a ceremony Friday morning for their showpiece Keystone XL pipeline bill that was part of the celebration. It was part celebration and part wake. they know that the XL pipeline is going to be meet Obama's veto. And trust me, Elmos, that's okay. Let him veto this bill and then go do it again. Get another bill and another bill and another bill and force him to veto, veto, veto. Hang on one second, folks. All right, there we go. That's what you got to do. That's the strategy. That's going to get you to the White House in 2016. If you don't get that down, you're just never going to have what you need to make the changes that need to be made. Speaker John Boehner, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and other GOP lawmakers assembled in the Capitol on Friday morning after a formal enrollment ceremony. And these are typically not much in the line of fanfare, but that's before they ship the bill to the president's desk. And though the White House has long warned that the bill was dead on arrival because Obama objected to the efforts of Congress to override his authority on the cross-border project. And that's okay. Come to Papa. Come to Papa. Veto that bill. The Republicans repeated their call for him to approve the measure, as well they should. The Elmos are not passing this bill just so Obama can veto it. They're not passing it just to be in his face. They want him to sign the bill. The public wants Obama to sign this bill. Obama should sign the bill, but he won't. And that's okay. If the Elmos do it this way every time, then they did their job. They passed legislation through both chambers of Congress, and the one-man obstruction crew put the kibosh on it. No problem. In fact, what would be the obvious fix? That's right, an Elmo president. It just makes it so obvious. It's really pretty simple. The Keystone Pipeline is a good idea for our economy and for our country. This is from John Boehner. To the president, I would just say this. Do the right thing, sign the bill, and help us create more jobs in America and create a healthier economy. He's still going to veto it. Bing, that common sense will prevail here, and the president will sign this extraordinary jobs bill. That's McConnell. Obama's still going to veto it. Of course, I wouldn't call it an extraordinary jobs bill. It's going to create 40,000 jobs. That's nice, but it's not an extraordinary jobs bill. But Obama's still going to veto it. That rhetoric was less heated than Boehner's remarks earlier in the week when he said Obama was standing with a bunch of left fringe extremists and anarchists. He should have stopped at extremists on that one, and it would have been just fine, but anarchists, you know, rather than the American people. Yep, no need to be volatile. Be civil. But Obama is still going to veto that bill. The Senate spent most of January debating the bill, the first submitted under the now Republican-controlled chamber, and the House voted in favor of the measure that the upper chamber had passed. No Democrats attended Friday's short ceremony, and this is key, folks. Them not attending, not a single one. This means that the Smurfs know that this is the Elmo's best avenue to the White House, that they pass these bills. and send them to the president's desk. They do not want to be identified with this. So even the Smurfs that voted for the bill did not show up for this ceremony. That's key to understanding why this is the right strategy for the Elmos to get to the White House in 2016. Republicans will wait to send the bill to Obama's desk until after next week. That would prevent him from doing a pocket veto while we have the President's Day recess. And submission will start a 10-day veto clock, not counting Sundays. Just like I said, regardless of the date, Obama will be sending this bill back to Congress with his objections. The president has announced that he would oppose and veto any legislation maneuvering to circumvent the State Department review process, Deputy Press Secretary Eric Schultz told reporters yesterday aboard Air Force One. So he will indeed veto it, referring to Obama. And that's okay, folks. Come to Papa. Come to Papa. Schultz declined to say whether the White House is planning a public veto event or private affair, noting that it wasn't clear exactly when Congress would formally send the bill over. Doesn't matter. The president has 10 days to pick his spot. Trust me. We all know Obama. This will be a public veto. He will make a speech as to why he's not signing it, why he's vetoing it, explaining why this is his call and that Congress cannot step on his executive toes, even though he has stepped on congressional toes time and time again. This will be a public attempt to get the public on his side on this issue. It hasn't worked yet. It certainly didn't work in past November. And Obama will continue to try. Some Republicans have suggested that they would attempt to override the veto through both though both chambers appear to be short of the requisite two-thirds required to do so. Nothing wrong with that. It will only solidify the concept that the only obstacle to the people's business is sitting in the Oval Office. Focus on that. Focus on that. Focus on that. Supporters are eyeing upcoming must-pass legislation, such as spending bills, on which they could include a Keystone rider. Don't. Excel's done. Rejected by the president and his fellow Smurfs. You tried. They stood in your way. They played obstructionist. They have become the party of no. Leave Keystone be and move on. Pretty soon you Elmos will have a long list that you can show America that will get done if they let you keep both the House and the Senate and they choose an Elmo president. It's that simple. It's really not that complicated. After the bill's demise, the decision on whether to approve the pipeline will remain with Obama, who is awaiting recommendation from the State Department on whether the pipeline is in the national interest. Obama isn't waiting for anything. He does not want to make this decision. He will either piss off his progressive base or he will piss off the electorate at his party. Obama is hoping that this decision, which was on his desk at the very beginning of his presidency, will still be on his desk 8 years later when he hands the job over to his successor. But this brings up a very good point and a very good observation. And fully paid for, this project, the Keystone Pipeline, fully paid for by private enterprise. Not a single tax dollar, not one. Unless you want to talk about this costly approval process, eight years it takes, really? How many projects that are shovel ready, that would create thousands of jobs, get bogged down this long over politics? The approval process was streamlined for what few shovel ready jobs we got from Obama's spendulous bill back in 2009 to 2011. And all of those jobs cost the taxpayers big time. Big. Huge. But this project, fully paid for with private money, just sits there. And so do the 40,000 jobs it would create. Middle class champion? Middle class economics? Harumph. Now, let's switch gears. I want to jump across the Atlantic to the Middle East because there comes a time when every radio show host has to apologize. Tonight, that will be me. You know, it's kind of, If you want to talk about this subject, by the way, or any of the subjects we talked about, 215-383-5730, 215-383-5730. Previously, I had said that Boehner's protocol faux pas, invitation to Netanyahu to speak at a joint session of Congress, paled in comparison to Jimmy Carter, a former president, going to the Middle East against sitting President George W. Bush's wishes to hug the PLO leaders. And it did. But I specifically pointed out Jimmy Carter because I know of no other president that usurped the president as our foreign policy leader. That is, until now. And I am so surprised as to who it is. From Politico. Late in the evening of Sunday, January the 18th, an 11-member delegation of the tribal leaders from Iraq's western Anbar province arrived in Washington, D.C. Just as their plane was touching down, Islamic State units ISIS units back in Iraq attacked the compound of one of the delegation's senior leaders, Sheikh Ahmed Abu Risha. Killing 9 Iraqi police officers and wounding 28 of the Sheikh's guards. A nearby Iraqi military unit failed to respond to repeated calls for help. Again, the Iraqi military totally dropped the ball. The brutal attack underscored the purpose of Anbar delegation's visit. The tribal leaders believed that they could defeat the Islamic State, but only if Obama's administration would agree to ship them weapons directly, bypassing Iraq's untrustworthy Ministry of Defense. They did not respond to their calls for help because they are at odds with these people. They are Sunnis, and as you know, the handpicked government for Iraq by Obama administration is Shia. In any case, yet after the arrival in Washington, the tribal leaders found themselves thwarted at every turn in their effort to meet with high-level administrative officials. They were told that they would have to take up these matters with the new Iraqi Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi, and would have to rely for weapons on those provided to them by Abadi's Ministry of Defense. They're not getting them. That is when George W. Bush called Abu Risha at his hotel in Washington. It's startling enough for a Sunni tribal leader to get a call from a former U.S. president. Yet, you like that, huh? Yet, oh gosh, I love it when I pull that stuff. Okay, yet, now look what you did to me. And even more so from Bush, who has been especially reluctant to interfere in world affairs since leaving office. But Iraq, after all, was Bush's baby. He knew about the tribesmen's difficulties as Islamic State fighters continue to make inroads against the Iraqi military, and he has been alerted to the delegation's visit in Washington by his contacts in the U.S. policy community. Abu Risha, the president of the powerful Anbar Awakening Council, said Bush listened carefully as the Sheikh explained in a 20-minute conversation that the Anbar tribesmen were unlikely to get any weapons from the Iraqi government, which, as Abu Risha claimed, is notoriously corrupt, beholden to Tehran, and more interested in arming Shia militias than Sunni tribesmen. Mind you, Obama could not negotiate a new immunity agreement so we could keep a contingency force in Iraq to keep the void from opening that allowed for ISIS to move into Iraq. And we went over that extensively in another show. But when ISIS proved to be more than a JV team Obama underestimated them to be, he had no problem ushering in the Iraqi government that stands there now, who happened to be heavily influenced by Iran, whom we are now toying with as an Iranian partnership to help us beat back ISIS. This has disaster written all over it. In the meantime, Obama has barely gotten started training those 5,000 moderate rebels in Syria Saudi Arabia, from groups who have sworn not to war with ISIS until they have defeated Assad together. the only people on the ground fighting ISIS on their own without any help from the U.S. are these Sunni tribesmen from the Anbar province of Iraq. Sunnis willing to fight Sunni terrorists. While the Obama administration and his and the Iraqi government starved these Sunni tribesmen of needed munitions. Meanwhile, the bombing campaign continues, and Obama brags that Jordan and the UAE dropped nearly 3% of those bombs, some coalition. I did hear that Egypt, by the way, started land shelling of ISIS positions. So that was good news. And then comes this new CNN poll. A new poll from CNN showed 57% of Americans do not approve of the way Barack Obama is handling the country's military actions against ISIS. 40% say that they approve of Obama's efforts, and 4% have no opinion. The poll, which was released Monday, shows a slightly lower approval than a September poll, where 49% were of Americans polled approved of how Obama was responding to the terrorist organization. So it's up from 49% of the 57% do not approve. It was 49% that approved. Let me see here. Yeah, approved back in September. So since that September poll was released, the Islamic State, the ISIS, has burned a Jordanian pilot alive in a cage, carried out attacks on satirical newspaper and kosher Jewish supermarket in Paris, and been held responsible for the death of American aid worker Kayla Mueller. It has also expanded its reach with new factions showing up in Libya and Yemen. So it is on the heels of this Obama strategy that the Anbar delegation flew to Washington. So Bush urged Abu Risha to extend his stay and meet with retired General David Petraeus, as well as the Republican Senator John McCain and Lindsey Graham. According to Abu Risha, Bush pledged that he would do everything he could to help him get a hearing in Washington. What amazes me here is that Bush, so long and by choice out of the political arena, felt the need to step in, even if it was just a phone call. Anyway, I apologize for pointing my finger only at Jimmy Carter. Of course, what Bush did still pales in comparison to what Jimmy Carter did. But nonetheless, I apologize. The Iraq Sunni Anbar tribesmen comprise a minority in Iraq, but have historically had an outsized influence in the government. That influence ended, of course, in 2003 U.S. invasion, which empowered Iraqi majority Shia population. Anbar Sunnis fought back, mounting a bloody insurgency against U.S. forces, allowing al-Qaeda recruiters to recruit fighters from Anbar, disaffecting the population. But al-Qaeda overplayed its hand, imposing their harsh vision of Islam on the Anbar's population. So beginning in mid-2004, the province tribal leaders began to shift their allegiance away from al-Qaeda, choosing instead to force the terrorist group out of the region. The United States supported this so-called Anbar awakening with arms and ammunition. Do you get that? We have done it before. We have sent the Anbar province direct munitions. We have done it before. But following the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, the Shia-controlled Iraqi government marginalized the Anbar tribes, providing an opening for ISIS. Did you get that? Let me read it again, because I know you Smurfs just refuse to believe it. But following the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, the Shiite-controlled Iraqi government marginalized the Anbar tribes, providing an opening for ISIS. Did you get that? Let me say it again, because I know you Smurfs refuse to believe it. Providing an opening for ISIS. Providing an opening for ISIS, which represented an even more virulent form of jihadism than appeared in Anbar in 2003, to advance. America's response has been to pressure Abadi's government Baghdad government to support the tribes, which isn't happening, which is why the tribal delegation from Anbar traveled all the way to Washington, D.C. The support has not arrived, and worse yet, the Shia-controlled Baghdad government has ensured that weapons are funneled to Iraq's Shia militia, many of which are under the sway of Iran and are cleansing Sunni influence in areas of eastern Iraq. The result is that in Anbar, the ISIS has gotten stronger while the tribes remain weak. So does it seem like we're fighting this war against ISIS to win? It does make you wonder. The Anbar delegation that arrived in Washington on January 18th hoped to reverse this policy, arguing that the United States should bypass Baghdad government in arming the tribes against ISIS, as they have once done against Al-Qaeda. Doing so, they believe, would spark an Anbar reawakening. The delegation, which in addition to Abu Risha, included all these names that I can't even say, but their 10-day schedule included a meeting with the White House aide, a visit to retired General John Allen, that's Obama's emissary to the coalition fighting the fighting ISIS at home, as at his home, as well as one-on-one meetings at the State Department and the Pentagon. They arrived confident that they would be heard. After all, the Obama administration had made a fight against ISIS a priority. And Allen had promised during the meetings with the Sunni tribesmen in October in Amman, Jordan, to pass their requests for arms to the Pentagon. But as their meeting in Washington went on, of course, their hopes faded. There were a lot of smiles, a lot of nodding heads, but that was it, one of the delegation members told the writer of this article. It's clear that the administration has made up its mind. Abadi is their man, and that's that. Another delegation member agreed, but was even more outspoken. We appreciate the meetings we had. They were fine, he said, but it is obvious that the U.S. officials were going through the motions. I wouldn't call it the cold shoulder, but it certainly was a cool shoulder. Mind you, these dudes are on our side. They are Sunni Muslims, and they are willing to fight these Sunni terrorists. Isn't that the message we want to send? Isn't that the message Islam wants to send? That Islam rejects what ISIS stands for so unequivocally that they, Sunnis, are willing to stand up and fight these phony Sunni Muslims to the death. They are still fighting to this day, even though they are outmatched, thanks to the U.S. and the Iranians' sympathetic government of Iraq. They are outmatched and they are still fighting. No one was going through the motions more than Vice President Joe Biden, according to several of the Anbar delegates. Biden surprised the delegation that afternoon of January 22nd by dropping in on their White House meeting with Phil Gordon, the administrator's coordinator for the Middle East, the North Africa, and the Gulf regions. Guy runs the whole area. The voluble Biden was at his best, smiling broadly and accompanying his handshake with his patented shoulder grip. Biden reassured the delegation that Abadi's government was working hard to restructure Iraq's military, and he urged them to cooperate with him. The vice president encouraged the delegates to continue working constructively with Prime Minister Abadi and the Iraqi government. A readout from the president's office concluded. Translation: keep doing what isn't working while more and more of you die. On the record, Anbar's delegates said they were pleased by Biden's visit. He's the vice president, after all. We're honored that the vice president took his time to meet with us. That's what Abu Risha said. But off the record, they were bitterly disappointed. We're interested in fighting ISIS, and the administration is interested in restructuring the Iraqi government, a delegate member said. In the meantime, ISIS is killing our people. Vice President's office did not respond to repeated requests for comments on the meeting. Can you understand these Sunni Muslims' frustration? I can. We people have been getting this kind of lip service for 6 years now. We would look at these Anbar tribesmen, shrug our shoulders and say, well, that's Obama. But even after meeting with Vice President Biden, the Anbar delegation did not give up. But Biden's view was reinforced, however, when delegate members at the Pentagon met at the Pentagon with Elisa Slotkin. the Defense Department's Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. Get that title? Defense Department's Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. The delegation had hoped to press their case with the officers of the U.S. Central Command, but had been told to meet with Slotkin instead. While Slotkin has spent 20 months in Iraq, she has consistently raised the ire of Senator John McCain for her testimony on U.S. policy in the Middle East, which includes a nasty exchange in December when Slotkin told Senate Armed Service Committee that the administration's strategy in Iraq and Syria was to defeat ISIS. McCain just couldn't believe it. Neither could I. That's a goal, not a strategy, McCain sputtered. I want to know what the strategy is. And this is why ISIS is not being beaten back. This is why, in ISIS eyes, they are winning. There is still no U.S. strategy for accomplishing our goal. None. There is just a goal: degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS. Slotkin's fared no better with Abu Risha's Anbar delegation. She's basically reiterated Biden's point, a delegate member said in describing the meeting, and seemed to have a lot of faith in Abadi. She knows Iraq, and we are pleased with that. But we were hoping to get someone in uniform, someone who can make a decision. You know what they were thinking when they said they were hoping to get someone in uniform, someone who can make a decision? They were thinking, yeah, but instead, they sent us this chick. Now, they may be on our side, but they are still Muslims. So there's that. And speaking of strategy, remember that in his State of the Union address, Obama cited Yemen as the place where his aerial strategy was a success story for his approach to counterterrorism. There's just one problem with that. In just the last week or so, Yemen fell completely apart, and several allied nations had to evacuate their diplomats and close their embassies, including us. Worst of all, we never saw it coming. From a Fox News report, the White House top counterterrorism official admitted Thursday that the overthrow of Yemen's government by Shiite rebels last month caught U.S. intelligence off guard. Nick Rasmussen, director of National Counterterrorism Center, told the Senate Intelligence Committee that Yemeni army's response to the advancing Houthi rebels resembled the Iraqi military's response to the onslaught by ISIS that ended in the capture of Iraq's second largest city past summer. And by the way, the forfeiture of a lot of military hardware that we had armed the Iraqi military with. You see, this is why we must be there. These people just don't have it. The terror groups that they must fight are just too terrifying for them. As the Houthi advances towards Sana'a, that's Yemen's capital, as that advancement took place, Rasmussen said, they were opposed in many places. The situation deteriorated far more rapidly than we expected. Rasmussen made the admission under questioning by Senator Roy Blunt, that's the Republican from Missouri, who noted that the President Barack Obama recently touted Yemen as a successful counterterrorism partnership. Oh, my. Okay, so that's the problem. Now it's a total disaster, Blunt said. The Houthis overran Sana'a last September and placed Yemen's U.S. and Saudi-backed president, Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi, under house arrest. And last month, along with the members of his cabinet, leading to their mass resignations. That was quickly followed by the disbanding of the country's parliament. Earlier this week, the U.S., the U.K., and France announced that they were closing their embassies in Sana'a and evacuating all personnel. British and French officials advised their citizens still in Yemen to leave the country immediately. The Washington Post reported Thursday that the U.S. Embassy's closure had also forced the U.S. to pull out dozens of personnel, including senior operatives who are now working with Yemen's government against the terrorists. Oh, well, all good things must end. So, folks, what they are all saying here is that Yemen was an unmitigated total disaster. Now we are negotiating with Iran to accept the deal that Iran offered us over a year ago, and we rejected so that we can say that Iran caved when it was us that caved. The deal is supposed to pave the way for Iran to help us, to partner with us, for us to rely on them to help us degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS, right? I mean, that is the plan. Call me and correct me if I'm wrong, but it has been reported in umpteen different sources. Wouldn't that be cool? Well, then there's this. That the Houthis, a Shiite Muslim group of rebels that overran the Yemeni government. We were just saying that, remember? Well, the success of the Iran-backed, did you hear that? Let me repeat it because it was a single hyphenated word, so you might have missed it, and I wouldn't blame you if you did. The success of the Iran-backed Houthis have proven to be a benefit to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, ACAP, the terrorist group's affiliate in that country. The group claimed responsibility for last month's deadly attack in the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and has recently stepped up attacks in central and southern Yemen. So that was just one paragraph, but let me rephrase it. The Houthis, backed by Iran, are a benefit to their affiliate, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who claimed responsibility for the Charlie Hebdo attack in France. So let's eliminate all the connector words here. Iran's financing responsible for Charlie Hebdo attack. And we and the French are negotiating with these Iranian idiots. Tell me who is or are exactly the idiots here. On Friday, Yemeni security officials say a suicide bomber struck police headquarters in the central city of Baida, which has recently been captured by the Houthis. There was no immediate word of casualties. The latest attack came on one day after the United Nations envoy to Yemen warned that the country was at a crossroads between civil war and disintegration, while UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warned that the country was collapsing before our eyes. The ambassador, Jamal Ben Omar, told the UN Security Council that this instability is creating conditions for Al-Qaeda, a Sunni extremist terrorist group, to establish a foothold in more parts of the country. His remarks came just hours after Yemeni military officials said Al-Qaeda militants seized control of an important army base in the south. That's how fast this thing was falling apart. Unmitigated and total disaster that took our intelligence personnel by surprise. You know, they ought to start rethinking about changing that name, intelligence, because it is seeming more and more the misnomer with each passing day. Well, that's a wrap for tonight's show, folks. And my pond will reopen tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Check the website to see what's up for Monday's show, 1111broadcasting.com. I hope you'll join us, and until tomorrow night, do what you love and love what you do. Good night, everybody.